for the policy likeliness to succeed in such a world is a policy based on a pattern of thinking of which disaggregation is a vital part, which is to say a pattern of thinking about national interests. Stop here.
Thank you very much. Who would like to ask, bring up the first topic for discussion?
What would you say to someone who would say, well, maybe we haven't been thinking about national interests, but in practice, we have put priorities. We put priorities. We didn't go into Angola in the mid-70s, and it was debated. In effect, what we were saying was Africa has a lower priority than Europe. So that we may not reflect, there may not have been a lot of reflection about that, but there was in the practice a kind of recognition of limits, of limited resources and so on.
I would agree that in the recent past, and especially in the 1950s, in practice, limits have been recognized by policymakers, if not publicized. We had set fairly firm priorities. The problem that I have with not making these priorities more explicit and not being satisfied with their existence in practice is that when peripheral challenges do come up, this universalist way of thinking and speaking that we engage in gives us no basis for saying no. I think that you could argue that we had a relatively hands-off policy for much of the world, for example, during the Eisenhower period. And yet, I think that, in particular, the fact and the perception of increased Soviet activity in the Third World created such anxieties among politicians and among the public also, that by the time the early 1960s came around, the national consensus was that we've got a problem out here, we've got to do something about it. And at the risk of seeming overly simplistic, I think that it was thinking like that led us into Vietnam. I think that we need some kind of an intellectual basis for that more standoffish posture. We need reasons to say no. We need reasons not to get involved when important things, again, whatever they are not at are not really at stake. That's the only response to that I can provide. Aside from saying that, I think that because I suspect that the fact that we decided not to go into Angola for all of the wrong reasons back in 1976 has contributed to the likelihood that our military, that our military involvement there will in fact increase in the near future. Perhaps not to the point of actually putting troops in, but certainly to the point of spending a lot more on it. To what end, I am not really sure.
Why do you say that the decision not to do this in 76 contributed to this? I mean, why should that contribute?
Well, I think that in the mid 1970s and in the late 1970s, quite a few people in this country, primarily on the left, essentially reacted to Vietnam by promoting non-intervention as a foreign policy and as such. When Americans became dissatisfied with that, people who were inclined not to be involved in places like Angola or like Nicaragua really couldn't come up with very good reasons for not plunging in. That's the main point there. I mean, people would say, well, they would say that the Russians and the Cubans were actually invited in. Therefore, there is no legal or no moral justification for us to become involved. People would say that in fact we wound up starting this thing first because we provided aid to the FNLA faction in the north, and that in turn prompted the massive Soviet and Cuban airlift of late 1975, early 1976. Nobody said that we shouldn't get involved in a country like Angola, because a country like Angola is of no importance to us whatever. Nobody said that. In fact, Henry Kissinger, once it became clear to Henry Kissinger that Soviet activity in Angola was going to cause real problems for his détente policies, he went around the country in the early winter and spring of 1976. And in one especially revealing phrase, in one speech, he said that the purpose of détente, or at least one purpose of it, was to put a stop to Soviet-American jockeying for position in areas of marginal importance. And the question that raises is, if the areas are of marginal importance to start with, what are we jockeying for? Who cares? That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think I understand that. What I don't see is why that should contribute to increasing American participation in this decade. I mean, 10 years later.
Because nobody came up with an especially compelling reason as to why we shouldn't be concerned about a Soviet-Cuban presence there. In fact, even the Carter administration officials, when they took over in 1977, kept on expressing concern about the Cuban presence in Angola. They kept on saying this is the kind of thing that we should be really worried about. Never explaining why a Cuban or a Soviet presence, again, in a country of only marginal importance, should be of concern to us. And I think that once again, people on the left and on the right have been talking so consistently about the problems posed by the Cuban presence there that you almost had to expect a significant number of at least right-wing political activists, if not the American people themselves, to start asking, why don't we do something about it? And once a congenial administration came into power, the question was asked even more insistently, and the answer they got was, well, why not? And so they are.
Because the terms of debate had been framed.
Exactly.
Non-intervention is a universally valid principle,
sure.
Or we, the other side, didn't start it first. So when you don't like the results of that policy applied elsewhere, you have no consistent ground for objecting to the alternate position of intervention in Angola.
And what I mean, I just recall hearing people like Assistant Secretary of State for Africa Richard Moose, Anthony Lake, the head of the policy planning staff at State in the late 70s, even Vance himself. Certainly the National Security Advisor was very big on the problems caused by the Soviet and Cuban presence in not only Angola, but in Ethiopia also. But what the Carter administration failed to do was it failed to explain to people why, if this was something that we ought to be concerned about, why aren't we trying to do something about it? I mean, Carter never even went so far as to recognize the MPLA regime in Angola. To start with, there was some talk about that in early 77, but apparently the right objected, and as was Carter's wont, he basically backed down in the face of those conservative objections.
See, Fritz, there are some alternative explanations you could have given for everything like this. One would be Kennan's explanation early on. It may be wrong. All of these may be wrong, but they are alternative explanations. Kennan said, we ought not to worry if the Russians gave aid to India. That in fact, there were parts of the world where we ought to give aid together. We ought to join forces because of the fact that these countries would not significantly affect the distribution of power. Another kind of reaction, which again may have been wrong, was something one of you talked about in your writings, namely the fact that there was a Soviet shipment of jet planes to Peru.
Right.
75.
That was in 75.
And nobody made anything of it. Nobody argued about it. In a sense, I remember that kind of argument in the private foreign assistance field when we used to say, well, don't worry if agriculture isn't working in Guatemala or in Honduras or someplace. These are banana republics. Again, that may be wrong, but it is almost an instinctive rationale for why you don't do something and is non-interventionist in that.
If you took an alternative, say the argument was what you suggested in 76, that this was really a very marginal country as far as we were concerned, didn't matter very much. It was worth getting involved. Would that have made any difference to the Reagan administration years ago if it didn't start getting involved? Or now, if you say we're running increased involvement, would it made any difference if in 76 we said, this is a
large election. Let me put it this way. I think that that had there been some significant political faction in the late 1970s arguing that there are really broad areas of the world that are really a very little concern to us, and that's why we needn't be concerned about Soviet adventurism. I mean, that in itself was a way of describing these various actions that were taken, which at once called attention to the problem, but then sought to sort of play its importance down. These Russian activities were called adventures. Adventures are not inherently serious, important things. Yet I think that was a distinction that was a little too subtle for most of us. Again, I like to think that had foreign policy thinkers been telling presidential candidates in the had they been telling prospective presidential candidates in the mid 1970s that there are really large portions of the world that are of very little concern to us, whether or not the Russians are involved or not, my hunch, and I can't prove it, of course, but my hunch is that would have struck a very sympathetic chord in a large part of the electorate, because the emotional predisposition of many Americans at that time was not to get involved in third world conflicts.
I remember hearing the present junior senator from Massachusetts speak at the Council on Foreign Relations, and in contrast to that kind of an argument, the argument he made then, he wouldn't make it today, I don't think, was not only that we didn't need defense for particular interests, but he said he couldn't see after Vietnam that we needed defense, period. So you've got a kind of an absolutist view. And an opposite of the absolutist view is the historic train of thinking, which is one reason I think national interest approaches are worth exploring, that tries to define a series of things. You defend your vital interest. What is a vital interest? A vital interest is something for which you're ready to fight. What are you ready to fight for? You're ready to fight for something that changes the distribution of power between you and your principal adversary, or an alliance of adversaries.
In ways that you don't want to accept.
In ways that you find unacceptable. And that mode of analysis, that mode of thinking, at least permits you to look at foreign policy problems in a different spirit than the spirit of writing off or saying that all the world is an interest. The other distinction that I think is, partly because I lived in that world so long, I think is worth making. Just because you write off Angola as a strategic foreign policy interest doesn't mean you write it off, or that individuals in the nation write it off as either a philanthropic, a developmental, or a private business interest. The Rockefeller Foundation didn't ask when we picked places to work, are they of the most strategic interest to the United States? We asked, is there a chance that you can, as our colleague used to say, that you can turn agricultural production around? So you can do a lot of things in the world in that sector.
If you want, right.
But you don't have to defend them in terms of there being a national interest.
Well, I have a feeling that we're talking as though we were scholars and not as though we're average citizens. It makes a great deal of difference, it seems to me, whether you do this publicly, whether we announce to the world, in effect, which we, or the president would do if he made a speech about it, mentioned it, that Angola is not a sufficient concern in the United States for us to go in there. isn't this about what Atchison said about Korea?
I think
should we ever announce publicly that this is an old such decision?
Well, you have a good section on Atchison.
In my piece, I spoke to that because that's in brief, what I said was that this is one of the this is one of the risks that you have to accept when you accept the fact that your power is limited, that you can't do all that you would perhaps like to do. And the risk is that at the same time, the risk itself is the risk is itself limited by the fact that the areas in which you make clear the fact that you have no compelling concerns are in fact not very important to you. So you are writing off areas, yes, but you are writing them off because they are not important. If I ever had the privilege of advising a politician, I would tell him never say, you know, I would tell him never say that you will never do something. And in fact, this brings us to a topic that we talked about earlier. I think that national interests do in fact change, and that they can change rather suddenly. But this is what Dean Acheson said, and I guess it was 1950. He in effect drew the American defense perimeter east of Korea, and then when the North invaded, this country decided, whoops, Korea is in fact important after all. The worst mistake that he could have possibly made. If it was important, he should have said so.
Wait a minute.
If South Korea was important enough for this country to fight in for 3 years, then Acheson should have included it in that speech.
And he meant,
he said one thing.
The argument about the speech from the people who worked with him, and it was that he had this in mind in terms of a general war. Wasn't that the proposition?
Yes, he thought it would be a diversion to have troops on the Korean Peninsula in a larger war.
In a larger war. And that's what he meant, but he left the impression. One of the differences, I think, is the difference and the distinction to be made between claiming, David kept using claim this morning, claiming that we have indiscriminate national interests all around the world, as the Truman Doctrine, as it finally emerged, seemed to do, and denying specifically that we have an interest in an area which could become an interest. And that's where it seems to me part of the problem.
It ought to be an area of ambiguity.
Ambiguity.
That's essentially what I was.
I guess I like to think that our leaders are or can be clever enough to keep an element of ambiguity in their speeches without crying wolf whenever something happens in the world that we don't happen to to like very much. But that is not extremely, but that is not extremely important to us. It can't be that hard to do. I hope it's not that hard.
On the question of whether national interests change, you may have read what Acheson said in 1951. What we must do is to be conscious of our national interests. A commitment is a national vital interest of which we have become conscious and for which we have made provision. But we may have national interests which are just as valid, of which we have not become conscious and for which we have not made provision, about which we should immediately become conscious and about which we should immediately make provision.
Well, of course, you can't address a problem unless you know that that problem exists, right? And I think that in the world things change, and they can change pretty fast. I think that one very important example of that change has been seen in the Persian Gulf from the early or mid 1970s on to the present. Whereas I personally would have included the Persian Gulf in my own list of American vital interests in, let's say, 1979, now I'm frankly not so sure. And in fact, we certainly cannot count on oil remaining plentiful and cheap. And this, to me, is the one area that is the hardest to judge. And my worries about it are increased by the fact that virtually every mainstream energy forecast of the mid-70s, at least until this point, turned out to be flat wrong. I think it is incredibly important for this country to try to come to some really sound conclusions about how much oil is going to be available at what price in the medium-term future. I think that is vitally important. I don't think the Reagan administration has addressed itself to that at all, out of a complacency that seems justified now, but you just never know.
Can I ask you about public opinion and how that all comes into this? It seems to be one thing that maybe is overlooked a little bit, that a policy as a guide to action, your arguments for policy, while certainly rational thinking people can disagree with, but a large portion of them can accept as well, it doesn't seem as easy to convince a nation that this is the kind of policy that they can support. It seems easier to convince a nation with a crusading ideology or bearing any burden. That type of talk seems much easier to get the backing of a country.
Well, I don't think that it's all that easy now. I think that it was easy before. I think that before Vietnam, even that wasn't especially easy. I mean, we were led into Vietnam not by ring. There was ringing. There were inspirational speeches and things like that, but it took a long, long time. It was done step by step. Our leaders thought that it would be risky enough from a public opinion standpoint to do most of it covertly, to do most of it by stealth, to lie consistently about it once it actually was done. I think that this may sound again a little too complacent and a little too pat, but my reading of public opinion owes a lot to the work done by William Schneider at AEI, although now that AEI is in trouble. I am not quite sure where where he'll wind up next. But he said in a in an anthology chapter about 2 years ago that in foreign policy, the American people want two things. They want peace and they want strength. And they don't really want too much else. I think that that if you look, if you measure the popularity of our worldwide commitments by the amount of controversy that they have generated among the public at large, not among foreign policy elites, but among the public at large, I think you can make a strong case that the American people have it just about right. They agree with the need for a strong American presence in Western Europe. They agree for they agree on the need to do a lot to defend Japan. Now, of course, we're seeing some unhappiness with the high price of this. We want the West Europeans to do more. We want the Japanese to do more. But I don't think that that there is any significant political faction in this country that opposes the idea of a strong American defense commitment to either of those two centers of industrial and economic strength. And I think that's a pretty sound choice. Again, the Persian Gulf, I think people still worry about oil, although they of course drive nowadays like they are in fact not worried about it. But I think that there is still strong support in this country for the idea of protecting Persian Gulf oil fields. I think that there is almost universal support in this country for aiding victims of what seems to be naked Soviet aggression in Afghanistan. There seems to be support for providing a fairly big amount of humanitarian food aid to Black Africa, and that's about it. There seems to be no interest in this country whatever for any kind of deep American involvement in Angola or in Nicaragua or in many third world countries. And again, I think that's a pretty sound set of priorities, and I think that a politician who ran on that platform would find pretty broad agreement on it. I really do. Who's calling?
I've been trying to get in for a while. I'm glad Worcester brought up public opinion. You sort of defined a list of priorities very neatly that you seem to want as an anthropologist.
Yep.
And you know, assuming all of that for a moment, part of the problem it seems that you're speaking to is when you have political leadership and you become aware of a national interest in some way representing this interest and not dealing with public opinion as a given, it doesn't want to be involved in Central America, but rather taking that given and saying, oh, but we now do have an interest in Central America, and then explaining that interest to the public in some coherent fashion. As long as you're dealing in the realm of ambiguities, how do you leave yourself ambiguous around the world and then approach a situation where you see an interest without creating some general principles which people will then use to drag you into conflicts where you don't want to be?
Again, I don't see the need for putting forth any general principles aside from the fact that we have to do what we have to do. I don't see the need for abstraction or for philosophizing at all on this. I think that that our commitments can and should be justified by the fact that they help us. And in theory, if a problem comes up in a new part of the world that requires a response, that response ought to be justified by insisting that that it fills a certain need of ours. And I think that in this country we really don't have much of a choice but to trust that the people will decide this matter rightly. And I think that we've got some we have some pretty strong reasons to be confident of this. If you look at what happened in the early and mid 1970s, all of a sudden the Persian Gulf becomes very important. If push came to shove, I don't think that a U.S. president who felt that he had to do something militarily to protect the oil fields would have run into a storm of public opposition. I think that it was clear enough to people that we needed the oil. Nicaragua, I have been incredibly impressed thus far with the public attitudes on that question. People have been hearing the most alarmist rhetoric now for 6 years. I mean, presidential speech after presidential speech, journal article after op-ed piece after God knows what, and more than 50% of the people in this country still cannot identify define the word Contra. I think that shows extraordinary judgment. This shows that they have actively decided that this is not worth paying any attention to at all. That is a viewpoint that I agree with very, very strongly. The Congress doesn't, apparently. But the polls still show that opposition to Contra aid is running 2-1.
I think what I'm getting at is a little bit different. Getting at more like marginal cases. Everyone can see that we have an interest in Europe, but most of our critical questions that we talked about here are the marginal cases where it's not really sure and things aren't necessarily so clear. Let's say you had a case, not Nicaragua, but like Mexico, and you're having to formulate a policy with Mexico where you don't want the regime to become unstable. At the same time, you don't want to create a problem if it doesn't exist. You want to have support from the public, but you don't want to tell the public, you know, we have to deal with Mexico's neighbors. How do you come up with arguments that will be legitimate in the eyes of the public in a case like Mexico, which then don't carry over and push you into Nicaragua as well?
I think you talk about Mexico, you talk a lot more about it than about Nicaragua. You can sort of engage in sort of rhetorical, ritualistic denunciations of President Ortega and his friends. But if you have a problem with Mexico, you talk about Mexico, and I think that again with the form of government that we have, the only answer is that our leaders had better be skillful enough to marshal support for action when action is in fact required, and I don't see any way to circumvent that. And in fact, I think that when we have tried to circumvent that, we've gotten ourselves into big trouble.
Seems to me it's a lot easier to agree on the virtue of discriminating than to agree on how to discriminate intelligently. And I'm not sure we've got any great guidelines. How do you convince the simple-minded fellow who comes along and says that it looks to me as if Nicaragua is as important to the United States as Italy, for instance? Is there a strong case for saying Italy is vital to the United States and some state in Central America is not? And so why? How do you make this case?
uh, are you asking how I would, or?
Well, if you're going to make discriminations, you're going to have to be in a position to say, this deserves priority and that does not. And then you've got to try to explain why this one does and that one does not deserve. That's what I mean.
I would personally talk about the size of the two countries, the GNP, the volume of trade that we have with them, the area of the world in which they are located. I think that you can talk about things like that, and it's not all that tough to do. I mean, I think that in a case such as Nicaragua, which is objectively speaking small and poor and weak, yes, I think it is very tough to convince the average Joe that it's worth much American effort at all, and that's why I think that public opinion has come out the way that it in fact has. I'm not sure how to.
Yeah, I'm looking for the rational device that one can use, enable one to say. Clearly, France is of vital importance to the United States. Clearly, Brazil is not.
When you say vital importance, do you mean?
Vital interest, one worth defending. That's what we've been talking about all the time.
I'm not sure that I see extreme. I shouldn't say that. That's obviously an awfully good question because I'm having a hard time answering it. France and Brazil is a comparison that I haven't thought about really, and it is awfully important.
And this is the reason some professors get
Brazil
all
is
discrimination
well,
is harder than non-discrimination.
Brazil is
talking about
the world's
the rationality of making some discriminations.
Brazil is the world's 10th or so largest economy. It exports a great deal to us. We sell quite a lot to it. We have big investments there. It is awfully important. I hate to say it, but my answer that France is important and Brazil is not may reflect two things. One, I am accustomed to thinking of Western Europe as a vital interest, and I am not accustomed to thinking of Brazil as one. And secondly, and related to that, I think that may be, in fact, the only.
But I think we do have that kind of historical bias.
Yes, there's no question.
We don't always stop to ask why.
Eurocentric bias, there's no question about that.
But isn't it significant you have more trouble with Brazil than you have with Nicaragua?
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's a much harder call.
I think this problem is complicated by one's worry about the acceptability of the what I would call the backdoor problem. I've seen lots of analyses in which you say it's terribly, Britain is of vital importance to the United States. And Britain has a backdoor, namely Western Europe, the Low Countries. So we have an interest in protecting the Low Countries because their protection is very important to Britain, which is important to us. And if you're going to protect the Low Countries, then you perhaps have to protect France. If you protect France, then you have to protect Italy. Everybody has a backdoor.
Right, sure.
And you can go all the way around the world this way very easily, and you've lost all sense of discrimination. But where do you stop paying attention to backdoors? I don't find that an easy question.
It's not an easy question. It's not an easy question at all. I suppose the only thing that I can say is that, in fact, not only can you go around the world drawing geographic links between regions, but U.S. policymakers have, in fact. There was a wonderful article in it was in International Security about a year ago by Robert Johnson of the Overseas Development Council, where he cited a series of recently classified memoranda from the early and the mid 1950s, and also closed door congressional testimony, where American officials actually went through this entire exercise from East Asia to the Persian Gulf to Western Europe. I think the only thing that I can say is that it's not an easy thing to do, but the fact that we are not omnipotent means that we have to establish priorities. I see no choice. And I quoted an axiom from Frederick the Great in my piece in Foreign Policy: he who would defend everything defends nothing. And I think that is as true now as it was then. The fact that choices must be made, and I would underscore again, they must be made by this inherently messy, slow process. The fact that they are tough doesn't mean that they don't have to be made.
Maybe some case studies help us. It'll take a while before we know how we got started in Nicaragua, but the Hague memoirs and the sources we do have suggest that when Hague came in, one reason he put the focus on Nicaragua was he said, this offers a chance for an early and relatively inexpensive success.
We can draw the line.
And the White House fought him on that and said, well, it may be a success as you see it, but we've got to deal with the budget, we've got to deal with the deficit. There are other things that mean more to the American people. And so there was resistance within the system in that way. And then the subsequent steps of fighting each step along the way on the Contra aid business. But that surely tells us something about
one thing that I would like to add is that perhaps what we have to do in the case of these very tough judgment calls is to listen to public opinion here. If let's say you have two countries that are of relatively equal weight, such as France, and Brazil. You simply have to try to take your cues from what the American people value most. Assuming that you can't defend both of them. If you can, then in a sense your problem is already solved. But for judgment calls like this, and especially when it comes to the question of taking on new responsibilities, I think that we have to try to figure out whether there is a real desire on the part of the public to actually do this. And in that regard, let me hasten to add that if I saw signs that there was a real groundswell of support for Contra Aid, I would not object. That would, in my view, be a very strong reason to actually provide it. But I don't see that.
Is that how does that make it a vital interest?
Is that what you meant when you said that foreign policy
helps you decide whether or not?
Is that what you meant when you said that foreign policy based on whim is as legitimate for a democratic country as one based on calculation?
I think it is. If the American people want to do something badly enough, they want to if they want to appropriate money for it, if they want to send troops for it, what can we do to stop it in this country? We can't do a thing.
Say this violates the national interest. You shouldn't want
it. One can argue against it, one can try to persuade people this is unwise, it's not worth it. But in the end, these are political choices, I think. And they're going.
How do your priorities really differ from the Reagan administration's in terms of the real priorities?
Well,
I mean, there's a lot of difference in rhetoric. The Reagan administration does have this universal outlook, but in fact, Reagan has not been
mainly.
The American people really do support Contra Aid. They certainly haven't clamored to cut it off and cut off supporting 15,000 troops. It's true they haven't wanted to invade, but they also haven't wanted to call them off either.
I guess the major difference is that I am unconcerned with Soviet activity in the Great Gulf of the Third World. That's the main difference. And although it has started slowly, I see the Reagan Doctrine winding up being a very, very expensive thing.
In particular case, which particular? I mean, I don't want to defend the Reagan Doctrine, but I'm not sure I'm being civilly that look, good enough.
Well, I mean, if you look at what we're doing in Nicaragua alone, there's now been 127 million appropriated by Congress for Contra Aid in the last 2 years. There's 300 million in economic aid for I believe other Central American countries. I read an estimate in the New York Times late last week that if you add the expense of all of the American military activities in that region that are specifically directed toward Nicaragua, you would have to add about 500 million more. If we assume that the 300 million in aid is not going to eradicate poverty in Central America over the next, in fiscal year 1986, you then have to assume that we will appropriate more aid. The Kissinger Commission talked about $9 billion. That's a lot of money. Since I don't see these relatively small sums accomplishing the aims that their advocates established for them, I have to assume that if they continue to support these policies, that they're going to want to spend more on them. And as I recall, Vietnam was a small country that we spent so much money on that we kicked off and inflation that lasted for more than 15 years. That was a highly destructive thing to our own economy. These things tend to start small.
Are there other places like Afghanistan?
Angola?
Afghanistan. A tremendous amount of money, $250 billion.
Afghanistan?
More than Nicaragua.
Afghanistan could be a real problem, too. There's no question about it. I mean, that could wind up being very, very expensive if this war drags on and drags on, plus you have to add the fact that it's right up against the Soviet frontier, that they don't want to leave, at least unless it's on their terms. if the Afghanistan war drags on for many more years, and if Graham Lundin-like cuts begin to really bite into programs at home, I'll bet you'll see people asking, gee, maybe we're spending a little too much here. Maybe we shouldn't spend quite so much. Maybe we should only spend half of it so much. Maybe only one half. In fact, what I thought was awfully encouraging in the contra-aid debate of earlier this spring, before the vote, which I believe was on April 15th, was you had a number of people on the Hill, like Mark Hatfield, I remember, saying, why are we spending, or why are we being asked to spend $100 million on this when we've got farmers going under? Now, people in the foreign policy field tend to look at that as being a very irresponsible thing to say. But in fact, I think that's an awfully good question. And I think that, again, as budget cuts begin to cut into programs that we all like and that we all value, people are going to start asking them more and more insistently, and I think they have every right to.
Mr. Graebner,
First of all, on this matter of what nations are more important than other nations, it seems to me that you have no way of answering that except through geography and history. That is, the general history of certain countries are important in international politics historically, and others aren't. That already separates France and from Brazil. I mean, creates a chasm between the two. And what you also assume to be your enemy, where your enemy is located, right, and the meaning of an attack on a nation, a threat to France, it simply means the world is gone. I mean, nothing left.
Right, well.
Yeah, but you can't visualize that kind of a threat to Brazil. On the other hand, let me suggest to you that if the Soviets tomorrow should send 12 naval vessels down to Rio de Janeiro and start bombing, in that moment, Brazil becomes far more important than France.
I think
because you've changed the rules of the game,
you
see?
I agree with that.
So I think that's the only way you can judge the relative importance of countries.
But only because I think Brazil itself has a critical mass of importance. I once used...
That's the reason I would put it way above, say, Nicaragua and others.
And for example, try to conceive, if you will, a Warsaw Pact tank invasion of Togo.
Would you give us a minute to try?
have 1 minute to try to conceive this. Now, according to the way that Americans have been thinking about foreign policy recently, that would automatically make Togo of truly vital importance to us, and I don't see why. Now that's, of course, an extreme case, but I still think that it is useful as we try to identify the right and the wrong reasons for responding to certain events out there. Again, events that we don't like.
So if we're setting up a hierarchy here, then we've established probably that any nation that possesses nuclear weapons is then important. I keep wondering about the case of Israel. I mean, you can say it's important because we've become accustomed to it, but it doesn't seem to satisfy any kind of criterion.
Israel
other than sort of we like it.
Israel.
How do you explain it in terms of interest?
What I just said was that the fact, if you have a tough call, the fact that we like it, which means that it is a politically popular country, means that that a strong commitment to Israel's survival would be sound foreign policy. I should say that Israel prevents an especially agonizing problem for me, because I consider myself to be a strong Zionist, and yet in terms of material in terms of material considerations and in terms of what is important to most people in this country, unfortunately for people like myself, if Israel was wiped off the face of the earth tomorrow, the republic here would still stand. I really don't see any overwhelming strategic rationale for a strong American commitment to the state of Israel. In fact, there was a very fine piece in our winter issue by Harry Shaw of Carnegie, and Shaw pointed out, and very convincingly, that the Israelis are not going to help us in the Persian Gulf. They're not going to do anything more than they have to do to keep getting lots of aid from us. And I think really that people like me really have to sort of try to make the argument for a strong U.S. Commitment and for high levels of U.S. aid, although perhaps not quite so high as they have risen today, from a moral standpoint, and it's sort of up. It is up to us to convince most people in this country that we should provide aid, and that we should provide help. And again, that's a foreign policy preference of mine. And thankfully, it is currently widely shared. If it was not widely shared, I frankly don't know what I could honestly do about it. I mean, I could resort to the tactics of other people who have seen their own particular their own particular favorite countries decline in importance. I could exaggerate the threat. I could exaggerate the strategic help that Israel could provide. I could hope that people had not read the piece by Harry Shaw. But in terms of making an intellectually honest argument, I don't think that I really could.
Russell?
Zach essentially stole my question.
Okay. I'd like to just speak briefly to your main thesis of today, because as a diplomatic historian, it seems to me that the question that you've raised here, why we don't think about national interest, is very central to the whole dilemma of American foreign policy in the 20th century. And it seems to me that the problem here is one of a self-perception that a nation has of its world role. When the United States was a smaller nation in the 19th century, it behaved like other nations. It had a body of interests, it had its hierarchy of interests, and pursued those, but never felt itself that it had any obligation to do more than just defend its own interests. In those nations, you do talk of national interests and the limits that they impose and so on. The problem, as I see it, is that when you enter the 20th century, America is the number one status quo power in the world, begins to identify its interests with a global status quo. And at that point, you cease to make distinctions anymore, because now moment on, you don't get the distinctions anymore. You don't talk about national interests after 1919. No one does. I don't think that FDR ever mentioned the word national interest. And so then you move on to the post-war period, and once you designate the Soviet Union as a global threat, your response is global, and again, you don't ask for distinctions. A threat anywhere is equal to every other threat. And then on the question of means, which you stated so well, if you think you can cover all bases, that simply accentuates it. Why do you have to worry about your threats in the Far East in the 1930s if you're convinced that your power will keep Japan from attacking?
Right. Sure.
And if you accept the doctrine of massive retaliation, Why do you have to make any distinctions? Because you've got everything blanketed out. And again, a tendency not to think in terms of specifics. And I recall that as late as 1964, in the New York Times Magazine, Walt Rostow wrote a piece in which he explained why there would never be a war in Vietnam. Because he says we have our policies in place, and we have more power than anyone else, and we're willing to use it to any level that is required, up to and including nuclear war, since no one will want to fight a nuclear war with us, therefore there's no danger of war in Asia. So you see the idea that you can blanket it out. So on the one hand, it seems to me the problem is blanketing the ends, and then kind of blanketing the means, and so you put the two together and you get a problem that I think is extremely serious. And as you do so well in your article, you hit it, I think, or it did in exactly as it should be hit.
Well, thank you. I think I missed that piece by Walt Rostow because I was only 11 years old when it came out. But that of course brings up the probably the most compelling argument that defenders of a universalist outlook bring up, and that is the need to preserve and to enhance American credibility.
Yeah. That's your global obligation.
And the problem with that, as I wrote, is that a pledge to defend everything is incredible, and a much more credible and a much more credible posture is to pledge to defend what you have decided is important to you. I think one other point that you passed over, I think a little too briefly, was the specter of a global Soviet threat. When people talk about that, I think what they miss is the fact that if the threat is in fact global and must be met everywhere, that the only proper response would be to turn this country into a garrison state. We would have to spend much more on our defense than we presently do. We would probably have to have confiscatory taxation. Nobody wants this in this country, and therefore that's why I am rather skeptical when people talk about a global Soviet threat. There's one other problem with this idea of credibility and a global threat, and it was raised, oddly enough again, by Jean Kirkpatrick, who wrote, she told Morton Kondracki, who then wrote it in a Wall Street Journal column, that if we don't set priorities, we wind up letting our foes choose not only choose the terms of engagement. We let them force us to fight them on their terms, and that's not smart. These are all problems that I'm concerned about, and that's one reason why I was involved in an exchange with Charles Krauthammer of the New Republic. Charles Krauthammer is credited, or perhaps I should say blamed, for coming up with the phrase the Reagan Doctrine. And he wrote
a Time magazine piece.
Well, this was, I'm trying to recall the point. Krauthammer objected to a response that I wrote to an article of his criticizing myself, Christopher Lane, Robert Tucker, and George Ken, in whose company I find myself pleased to be included. And he said at one point that this appeal to national interests doesn't tell us what we actually ought to do. It doesn't tell us where to act, where to respond. As a number of people have pointed out here, and I responded that what we need first is to learn how to think rather than how to act. I think that I am optimistic that if we learn how to think wisely about foreign policy, we will act wisely. It's not guaranteed, but the odds are sure a lot higher than if we persist in thinking unwisely about it.
Yeah, the only problem with that, I agree with 90%, but the only problem is why does Jean Kirkpatrick act the way she acts when she gets into the political arena?
I've been asking myself that question.
No, she says to everybody that will listen that the one book she has on her bedstand is Morgenthau's In Defense of the National Interest, and she writes things and makes speeches of the kind you make. Yet in the political arena, people get driven. I had never heard of on foreign policy of Krauthammer, but since he wrote these two or three pieces, why every other talk show has
had. Yeah.
And he said, you suddenly become a spokesman for this nationalistic universalism, and an oracle, even if you haven't written a line on it before. So it is a troublesome problem, but maybe in the long run it can work out.
Reed, you've been holding your hand up for some time.
Well, that was some time ago, and the precious moment has passed. So,
then we'll let David Grasslick ask the last question.
Oh my. I sort of have a complimentary and yet cynical view of your presentation. I'm sympathetic to your point about national interests, but what struck me when I read the article about how you presented your case is that I didn't want to agree with it. And because it was as much a case as seemed with the language you used for saying, I disagree with policy as we frame it today. And when you're making the world presentation, say, I want to have a less ambitious foreign policy for the United States, one could easily say that you aren't saying that we need to have a national interest. Rather, what you've done is you've taken your opponents who defined a national interest, you've defined them in the corner and said, but they really don't believe in a national interest. And now I'm going to tell you we need a case for the national interest. And in the process, all you've really done is taken a particular view of foreign policy and given it the mantle of the label of national interest we've all come to know and respect over a number of years. And it seems to me that's one of the dangers that you can get into with this type of debate. And a lot of people would be then very willing to dismiss something and say, oh, it's just another piece about why we have to retrench in this modern world and we have to look at different problems. Is there a way that you can get around something like that and explain that I'm not trying to be critical of particular foreign policy. Rather, I'm trying to identify the fact that it wasn't being cognizant of some type of objective. One qualification I want to add. The other thing I have problems with is that at that point then, maybe a view of leadership, which is probably a different question, but I think factors in. You kept retreating to that I want the public to decide. And yet some people would be saying you're having a national interest. You have people who shape opinion. And that the opinion makers should be defining the interest and presenting it to the public, because the public can only know what someone tells it. It doesn't have this knowledge that just is imminent. It does, God doesn't put it in the public's minds and then tell them to vote. It's rather that the leader tells them something. And they take this information. Is there any way you can incorporate something more to do with that?
Well, I would simply urge people who help to mold public opinion to think about things the way that I do. And that's the only hope that I really see. Regarding your first question, what I tried to do in the piece was to examine the foreign policy debate as it had unfolded for a particular period of time. I tried to provide examples of both national leaders, opinion leaders, and all that, talking about foreign policy, but make, uh, but never talking about the idea of specific, intrinsically important national interests. I quoted Kissinger. I think that I presented quite a few examples in the limited space that I had. I wound up cutting that piece in half, and I can assure you there are many more examples that I could quote. I am confident that I could quote enough examples to show that when people talk about foreign policy, they talk about everything but. And I think that if you think about the importance of the debate over the questions that I listed at the start of my talk here, a number of which I examined in the piece itself, Weinberg and Schultz on the use of force, I mean, I was just so struck by the attention that this debate got, billed as one of the truly mega debates since 1945, and not one of them addressed the question of what's important. And I frankly don't see the purpose of talking about when and where to use force unless you come to some decision of what is important to you. David Ignatius of the Wall Street Journal, I believe, now with the Washington Post, but wrote a column when he was with the Wall Street Journal. He was the only person that I can think of who pointed out that this debate took place in a strategic vacuum. It meant absolutely nothing. And I tried to show in my piece how inconclusive that debate really was. So I think that I feel confident in saying that my piece was really not a covert activity aimed at promoting my own secret agenda for U.S. foreign policy. In fact, if you'll recall also, the piece said it is in theory possible that examining what is intrinsically important to us could result in a consensus around a more ambitious worldview than we have now. And that statement, and you'll have to simply trust me on this, was not insincere.
Okay. Maybe there's one qualification I can make. If I wanted to write a piece to change foreign policy, I wouldn't want to say I want to change foreign policy. Rather, I would want to write a piece saying that I want to have financial interests. I would have written it as you wrote.
So few people don't have it. And okay. Isn't that revealing? Almost no one does.
I think the problem, though, you stated a little earlier, and that is that when I commented on the globalism and you said, well, American policy isn't all that global. Well, the rhetoric is global.
Yes.
The rhetoric is global. The power is a far cry from being global. It's very limited. And particularly when most of the things that go wrong in the world are at such a low level of importance that you're not going to get involved in a military strategy over it anyway. So the result is, what else have you got left to try to manage the world? You can't do it with your power. That's obvious. The only thing you try to do is manage it with your words. And by keeping what? By keeping them guessing. By keeping them guessing. Now, when you try to keep them guessing, of course, you use globalist language. And I think one reason why there's a lot of objection to your approach, you had one. But I think the basic one is it's the Korea example, which I think is a very bad example. But that Korea example, there, take one little place of the world and say, that is not our interest, somebody's going to hit. And then you've got the problem. Then what are you going to do about it? In other words, the supposition, and I think you handle it very well in your article, because you say it's not true, but there's this basic view in America that there is that the only thing that fills the vacuum is America, nothing else, and we alone fill the vacuum. And therefore, you fill that vacuum with a rhetoric that never gives in.
And there is
so at the one moment you say, "But we've got to make choices," but we make no choices. You see, We don't do it because I think the idea is you're going to give something away. Or you're you use the word invitation, proper. Invitation for somebody to address, and you won't have to face the United States. And I think that's the dilemma we're up against. And until you can break this idea that there is a vacuum in the world that we only fill, there's actually, it's being filled by 160 nations, not one of whom you can push around, not one. That's the reality. But you see, that's something that they never talk about. No, just that the whole vacuum is filled only by the United States. That is true. You see, you've assigned an enormous burden to this contract. And how do you sustain that burden? Lots of power and lots of noise. The only way you can do it.
I guess I agree with the thrust of that. I think that not only do people see much of the world as a vacuum that must be filled, but as I said at the end of my talk, I think people have a very difficult time because of these very hazy but very powerful integrationist thoughts that are floating around there, have a very difficult time acknowledging or I should say coping with the likelihood that what happens in country A does not necessarily affect country B, because countries A and B are located far apart, they don't trade, they don't really do too much with each other. There is an emotional problem here. There is just, people simply think that this is so that the world is becoming smaller. That's one more phrase that we hear all the time. Therefore, if the world is becoming smaller thanks to AT&T and Sprint, then obviously what happens only a phone call away must affect us. And one topic or theme that I really like to explore is the extent to which these advances have affected political relations and have affected security considerations. I think that they have a lot less than we think, and I think that they will, for the foreseeable future, have much less effect than we think.
One thing that would be interesting to write about sometime if you follow up all of this, it is the way things have converged to accentuate and perhaps an existing tendency that people have talked about toward this negative attitude about national interest. It's European. It's too much European. We don't want Frederick the Great. We've fled from all of that. Then there's communism. Well, on whether it's labor unions or corporations or whoever it is, that's a church group, whatever it is, we're all united on that. And that's global and universal. We're international. We still hold on to this dream of a brave new world, a different world. But so do the isolationists in a way. The isolationists, in a way, as some pointed out in the 50s, don't want to have not anything to do with the world, but they want to have something to do with the world entirely on their own terms. And that comes together. That's why Nolan and other people, so far as Asia was concerned, wanted to go further than the internationalists did. And when you get four or five factors of that kind all coming together, well, then you do have real obstacles to thinking about the national interest. And so it's a worthy subject.
Well, I think we've all been enlightened about it today. And we thank you very much for coming.
Or at least for
looked. Well, isn't that the first step? Appreciate the attention.
Thank you and Dan, too, for your contribution.
So.
Certainly.
So.
Thank you all for attending.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you.